Welcome, everybody. Again, for those who haven't met me, my name is Art Galwitzer. I'm president of our local chapter, and I want to thank you all for coming to this today and to those who made the reception last night. I'm going to introduce our next speaker, and our next speaker needs very little introduction. He is a public policy graduate of Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. He is a graduate of Harvard Law School, former law clerk to Chief Justice Rehnquist, former Solicitor General of our state, and now United States Senator and a very good friend of the Federalist Society. It's my pleasure to introduce Senator Ted Cruz.
Good morning. It is great to be with so many friends from such long standing. It is great to be with the Federalist Society, so many lawyers, so many aspiring lawyers. I don't know if you saw in the news clips that scientists are actually starting to use lawyers instead of rats in their experiments. There are two reasons for this. Number one, the scientists were growing too attached to the rats. And number two, there's some things even rats won't do. The Federalist Society is a remarkable institution. I joined the Federalist Society as a 1L when I was 21 years old, so I've now spent over half of my life as a member of this institution. And this is an organization dedicated to the understanding that ideas matter, that the Constitution matters, that freedom matters, and that standing up and articulating those ideas in civilized discourse can change the direction of our nation. Federalist Society branches all over the country, whether in law schools or whether in lawyers' chapters, understand that you can have people who disagree and sit down and reason together. And you know, all of us mourned earlier this year the passing of Justice Antonin Scalia. He was someone who, for many of us, we considered a friend. He was someone who, in many ways, was the patron saint of the Federalist Society. There, at the genesis of the Federalist Society. And Justice Scalia's career, I think, demonstrates the power of ideas. You look at Justice Scalia when he was a law professor, and then when he was a judge on the district court, and then when he was a judge on the circuit court, and then when he was a Supreme Court justice. Over and over again, he articulated ideas. Legislative history. Go back and take a look at statutory decisions from the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s. Over and over again, the Supreme Court, just every other court, would typically begin with legislative history. Would begin with, here's what this committee report says. Here's what the history is. Half the time you'd read through the decision, you wouldn't even find the text of the darn statute. And Justice Scalia began what was initially a very lonely effort to make the case that law is actually, in the case of federal law, what has passed Congress and been signed into law by the president. And that the text is central. And some knucklehead committee staffer writing a committee report cannot change the text of the law printed in the United States Code. It's difficult to overstate what a crazy proposition that was when Scalia began making it. And he began making it alone. He began making it in lonely dissents on the D.C. Circuit. He began making it in lonely dissents on the U.S. Supreme Court, where his colleagues were looking and said, what are you talking about? This is the way we do it. And yet, through force of argument, through force of reason, every one of us who practices law now, Antonin Scalia changed the way we practice law. If you're litigating a statutory interpretation case, you start with the text. Any competent lawyer, if you're not, it's malpractice. If you're a judge, even lefty judges start with the text now. That is an amazing transformation in how judges do their job. It's an amazing transformation in how lawyers do their job, what law means, and he did it through the force of the power of ideas. Likewise, originalism. The notion that the words of the Constitution are not simply free-floating in the universe, but rather that the original understanding of what those words meant informs their interpretation. When Justice Scalia began arguing for that, that too was considered a fringe idea. And yet the power of argument in the Federalist Society played a critical part in both of those roles. Statutory interpretation and constitutional interpretation. Now, the Supreme Court on a constitutional case, both sides, no matter where you are on the jurisprudential side, will be arguing about the original understanding of the text. There'll still be disagreements. But now suddenly people understand the importance of the understanding of the framers. That is transformational and it's incredible. You know, I'm reminded of one of my favorite stories of Justice Scalia. And it's back from the mid-80s, when at the time, Justice Scalia and Robert Bork were the two leading conservative judges on the D.C. Circuit. And Ronald Reagan was in the White House. And everybody knew that the next Supreme Court vacancy, it was likely to be either Scalia or Bork. They didn't know who, but they knew it was going to be one of the two in all likelihood. But one day, Justice Scalia is walking through the parking garage of the D.C. Circuit, and he encounters two U.S. Marshals who stop him. Say, excuse me, sir, we're holding this elevator for the Attorney General of the United States. And Scalia pushes past them both, steps in the elevator, jams the button, and as the door is closing, he says, you tell Ed Meese Bob Bork doesn't wait for anyone! That is a true story. And in 1986, Ronald Reagan nominated Antonin Scalia to the Supreme Court. So small things can make a difference in the course of history. You know, today is Constitution Day. Or, as President Obama refers to it, what? Today is a day when we reflect on what it means to have the Constitution of the United States. The Constitution of the United States is an extraordinary document. It's an extraordinary document because it reflects something that has been an exception from much of the history of mankind. If you look back on the history of humanity, much of it is a history of oppression. It is a history of suffering and serfdom. It is a history of the people being told you are subjects to kings and queens and monarchs and emperors. And that rights are given like grace, like crumbs from the table of the ruler. The Constitution was an extraordinary moment where, number one, this country began with the radical proposition that our rights don't come from monarchs, they come from our Creator. And number two, that sovereignty doesn't begin on top with a ruler and monarch. Instead, it begins on bottom with we the people. It is difficult to overstate how radical those concepts were. That we the people, each individual is given by God certain unalienable rights, that among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that we as a people lend sovereignty to government. As Jefferson put it, the Constitution serves as chains to bind the mischief of government. I'm reminded today of the words of Daniel Webster. He said, "Hold on, my friends, to the Constitution and to the Republic for which it stands. Miracles do not cluster. And what has happened once in 6,000 years may not happen again. That puts into context just how extraordinary, just how unusual, just how rare and precious this freedom that we have is. And what I want to do this morning when it comes to thinking about the Constitution and Bill of Rights is take what I'll call a random walk down 5-4 decisions. Because it is a sad reality that in our nation, the Supreme Court of the United States has become the arbiter of the vast majority of our rights. That's not how the constitutional system was designed. It's not what the framers envisioned. But after years and decades of usurpation, it is the reality. And one of the things I know about the men and women of the Federalist Society, whether you are conservative, whether you are libertarian, whether you're just ornery, is that you cherish the Bill of Rights. And if you look at the Bill of Rights, let's start with Justice Scalia's most significant opinion of his tenure, the Heller case. The Heller case, as the folks here know well, concerned the Second Amendment, the individual right to keep and bear arms. Heller was 5-4. The position of the dissenters, it's worth pausing to reflect on for a moment. The position of the dissenters was not that some reasonable gun control is sometimes acceptable. The position of the dissenters, rather, was that the Second Amendment protects no individual right to keep and bear arms whatsoever. That the Second Amendment is merely a collective right of the militia, which, if that is right, means nobody in this room has any individual right whatsoever to keep and bear arms. The position of the dissenters was a position which, if adopted, meant for all practical matters, the Second Amendment becomes a dead letter. Becomes an interesting historical artifact. But under the position of the dissenters, if Congress tomorrow passed a law making it a felony for any American to own a firearm, no individual would have any right to challenge that. That position got 4 votes on the Supreme Court. We are 1 vote away from the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms being effectively removed from the Constitution. That's a radical threat. Let's take the First Amendment, the amendment that really is foundational to all of our other rights. Let's talk about religious liberty. Many of you are familiar with a case I was intimately involved with here in Texas, Van Orden versus Perry. The defense of the Ten Commandments monument that sits just a couple of blocks from here on the state capitol grounds. In that case, an individual plaintiff, an atheist, filed a lawsuit demanding the Ten Commandments be torn down. He said it offended him to gaze upon the Ten Commandments on government land. That case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and Texas won 5-4. That case not only preserved the monument here, it preserved Ten Commandments monuments all across the country. What does that mean? Of those 5, just like Heller, Scalia was one of those 5. There were 4 votes to say, tear the Ten Commandments monument down. And by the way, don't just do it from Texas. Do it, for all intents and purposes, all across the country. We're 1 vote away from that decree. Another religious liberty case I was very actively involved is the Mojave Desert Veterans Memorial. Mojave Desert Veterans Memorial is a lone white Latin cross. It was erected over 70 years ago to honor the men and women who gave their lives in World War I. And the ACLU filed a lawsuit challenging it, and they won. They won in district court. They won in the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit ordered that a burlap sack cover the monument with a chain at the bottom and a padlock. Because you could not gaze, the court said, on the image of a cross on federal land. In that case, I was representing about 3 million veterans pro bono. We defended that monument, and we won 5-4. 1 vote away from that veterans memorial, and for that matter, veterans memorials across the country being ordered torn down if they contain any religious symbols. By the way, you know, one of the rich ironies during the Ten Commandments arguments. Does anyone here know how many times the image of the Ten Commandments appears in the courtroom of the Supreme Court? This is a geeky audience. Someone might know. I mean, this is... In almost any other room, the answer would be no, but surely Fetzalk. Okay, the answer is 43. 43. It appears twice on the doors as you're walking out of the courtroom, carved into the doors. It appears 40 times on the brass gates, up and down the pillars. And then the justices, as they are sitting on the bench above their left shoulder, is Moses looking down upon them, holding the Ten Commandments in his hands. And yet four votes are ready to say, tear it down from any public display. These are radical propositions. And as bad as this court is, and I suspect many of the people in this room have significant issue with many of the decisions of this Supreme Court. As bad as this court is, we are one vote away from something we have never seen in the history of our country. A radical court where our basic rights are stripped away. Let's take another aspect of the First Amendment, free speech. The Citizens United case, which the left loves to vilify. Now, Citizens United concerned a movie maker that made a movie critical of Hillary Clinton. Hard to imagine anyone would be critical of Hillary Clinton. And the Obama Justice Department wanted to fine the movie maker for daring to criticize Hillary Clinton. Most people don't know. Those are the facts of the case. Can you fine a movie maker for making a movie critical of a politician? Now, I have a crazy view on the First Amendment. I believe it actually means what it says. Hugo Black famously said, "No law means no law." Even more chilling during the oral argument. The Obama Justice Department was asked, under your interpretation, could the federal government punish a book publisher for publishing a book critical of a politician? The answer from the Obama Justice Department was yes. Yes, they could. Citizens United was 5-4. You want to talk about political forces. President Obama famously at the State of the Union upbraided the Supreme Court, the justices sitting there, some of whom no longer attend the State of the Union because of that night, upbraided them for having the temerity to protect political speech. Hillary Clinton, as a candidate, is actively campaigning, promising, we're going to reverse Citizens United. Let me tell you how bad it is. The United States Senate, some of my colleagues introduced a constitutional amendment to repeal the free speech protections of the First Amendment. I'm not making that up. In the wake of Citizens United, they wanted to give Congress plenary authority to regulate political speech. If any individual spent, the original version of it, if any individual or group spent any money whatsoever, Congress had full authority. It meant if you decide to put a billboard up on your backyard, Congress could make that illegal. If a labor union decides to organize people to speak, Congress could make that illegal. If a little old lady goes down to Home Depot and buys a poster board and a stick and makes a yard sign spending $5 to put it on her front yard, Congress could make that a felony and put her in jail. Those were the terms of this amendment. They then retreated from those terms to an amendment that was not quite as egregious, that at least didn't apply to individuals, just applied to corporations, but applied to all corporations, and gave Congress blanket authority to regulate the speech of all corporations. Now, when people think of corporations, they sometimes think of, you know, ExxonMobil or what have you. But the NRA is a corporation. Under this amendment, Congress would have the authority to decide whether and if the NRA can speak on political speech. The NAACP is a corporation. Under this amendment, Congress could decide whether the NAACP gets to engage in political speech. It was breathtaking. I'll tell you, in the Senate Judiciary Committee, I introduced a substitute amendment that began with the words, "Congress shall make no law." It's word for word the text of the First Amendment to the Constitution. Every Senate Democrat voted against it. On the Senate floor, I gave a long floor speech opposing this amendment. I had behind me a quote. A couple of decades earlier, the Democrats had tried something similar. Ted Kennedy had responded, "We haven't amended the Bill of Rights in over 200 years. It's no time to start now." I had a giant poster board with Ted Kennedy's quote behind me. My father saw it on C-SPAN, scared the living daylights out of him. I immediately started getting texts from my dad going, "Good God, you've gone native." But there was a time when Senate Democrats considered themselves defenders of civil liberty. In fighting against that amendment, actually a group that I quoted on a daily basis was the ACLU, who to their credit opposed this amendment, pointed out, under this amendment, the ACLU said, Congress could criminally prosecute the publication of Hillary Clinton's book, Living History. Now, on literary value, that may be worthwhile. But as a matter of free speech, that's nonsense. When it came time for a vote on the question of whether we should pass a constitutional amendment to remove the free speech protections of the First Amendment, do you know how many Democrats voted to preserve the First Amendment? Zero. Truly stunning. Constitution Day 2 years ago, I was at the National Constitution Center. They invited me to participate in a debate on this amendment to change the First Amendment. Pretty darn important on Constitution Day. I accepted. They invited a series of Senate Democrats. Every one of them turned them down. They weren't willing to defend their proposition. Chuck Schumer turned them down. Dick Durbin turned them down. I ended up doing a 45-minute debate with myself. Pretty sure I won. But it says something about our political discourse. The threats we're facing that our basic rights are in jeopardy. Issue after issue, you look at the Supreme Court, and they've been decided 5-4. If you care about the right to life, when Congress passed legislation banning partial birth abortion, the Supreme Court upheld that legislation by a vote of 5-4. There were 4 votes willing to say even partial birth abortion, the horror that that is, cannot be legislated against. We're 1 vote away from every restriction the states have put in place on abortion over the years. Whether government funding, whether partial birth, whether parental notification, we're 1 vote away from every one of those restrictions being struck down. If you care about school choice, the civil rights issue, I believe, of the 21st century. A critical mandate for justice for every child, regardless of race, skin color, income, zip code, every child to have a right to access to a quality education. The seminal case upholding school choice, Zelman versus Simmons-Harris, was decided 5-4. We're 1 vote away from the Supreme Court concluding every school choice program in the country is unconstitutional. If you care about immigration and executive overreach, President Obama's illegal executive amnesty, Texas led the charge, suing to stop it. Texas prevailed. The Supreme Court sided with Texas, 5-4. Scalia was one of those 5. The Obama administration's massive regulations on coal, massive global warming regulations that have the potential to kill millions of new high-paying jobs. The Supreme Court stayed the effects of those regulations 5-4. We're one vote away from an almost entirely unshackled executive. If you care about U.S. sovereignty, an issue that I know is near and dear to the men and women gathered here. Medellin versus Texas, a case I spent years fighting to defend. Concern two questions. Number one, does the world court, does the United Nations have the authority to bind the U.S. justice system? And number two, does the President of the United States have the authority to order the state courts to obey the world court? On both of those issues, Texas prevailed. Supreme Court effectively struck down the world court's order trying to bind our justice system, concluded the president lacked the authority to unilaterally bind the state courts. And yet that decision, when first rendered, was 6-3, but then on subsequent stays ended up being 5-4 again. Justice Scalia was one of those five. This random walk down 5-4s is intended simply to make folks reflect upon the breadth of our rights that are hanging in balance. It is hard to find a constitutional right that is not in jeopardy with the coming nominations. I think that, for me, underscores the importance of this presidential election, of having a president who will appoint principled constitutionalists, and it also underscores the importance of having a Senate that will impose real advice and consent, that will be a check on one more lawless activist on the court. And our basic rights are profoundly jeopardized. And I'm grateful for the men and women here because y'all are committed to those rights. You're committed to the Constitution. And closing where we opened. You know, we started this morning talking about how Antonin Scalia is a lonely voice, talking about principles that were true and right, managed to change much of American jurisprudence, managed to change much of how courts and lawyers approach their jobs every day. I think that same example, I hope, should inspire all of us to stand up and speak out and defend those precious liberties we were given. As Webster said, that miracle that happened in Philadelphia 2 centuries ago, each of us has to defend it. And I'm grateful for the commitment of the men and women of the Federalist Society to doing exactly that. Thank you. And now, time permitting, happy to answer a few questions. Judge. Ah, great question. And with judicial brevity, the full text of the question was the internet, which communicated every single thing. So we are in the midst of a big battle right now in Congress over the internet. And let me take a little bit to explain the background of the issue, because it can seem a little complicated, but at the end of the day, it's profoundly important. The United States invented the internet. Much of it was with taxpayer funding, the early foundations of the internet, and it's transformed the world. It has transformed how we do commerce, it's transformed how we communicate, it's transformed how we live our lives. If you have a crazy, meaningless question about a celebrity at 2 a.m. on a Thursday, you can pull out your phone and within seconds know the answer to it. It's really changed how bar bets come out. Now, the basic plumbing of the internet. Right now, there is a group, a nonprofit based in California called ICANN, that is in charge of helping administer the plumbing of the internet, helping administer top-level domain names, .com, .org, .net, .mil, .gov. It does so on a contract with the United States government, the U.S. Commerce Department. As a result, the way the internet is run right now, America is the only country on earth that has the First Amendment to our Constitution, that has the robust free speech protections we have. And so the internet today is free from censorship. You do not have the domain name registrars censoring, is what you say acceptable? Is what you say permissible? Instead, as a public service to this country and the world, we have maintained the internet as a free speech zone, free of censorship, free of control, where people can speak their heart's content. The Obama administration has announced its intent to allow the contract with ICANN to expire, to end the federal government's oversight of the basic plumbing and infrastructure of the internet. And the consequence of that, they want to transfer it instead to what's called a multinational community of stakeholders, which just hearing that phrase ought to scare the living daylights out of you. But it is essentially a mini UN where every country gets an equal vote, which means our standing will then become the same as Russia and China and Iran, countries that are avowed enemies of free speech on the internet. And what the Obama administration is proposing doing is handing over this power to ICANN. We had a hearing that I chaired this week on this issue where the administration's testimony was essentially, trust us. They said, you should trust the international community of stakeholders. Now, I said, first of all, I said, listen, tech companies, they're wonderful. God bless them. But do you think they've been good and effective stewards of free speech to date? You look at a number of huge tech companies that have agreed with the European Union to censor so-called hate speech within 24 hours to take it down if it's deemed offensive. Tech companies have already agreed to do that. That's good business. You want to do business in China? Guess what? The big tech companies cooperate with China in censoring the internet. So imagine if you're at home and you type in a search and suddenly you get a warning that comes up, this search is not allowed. Now, in China, that might be accompanied with police knocking on your door to take you away. And handing this over to a handful of giant corporations, none of those corporations are bound by the First Amendment. None of those corporations, they have financial incentives to maximize their profits. That's great, but I'm not willing to trust them with your and my freedom. It is only the United States of America that is bound by and respects the First Amendment. Indeed, the CEO of ICANN, when I asked him very directly, I said, are you bound by the First Amendment? He said, no. We're having a fight right now in Congress over whether to prevent Obama from handing this over. Existing legislative language and existing rider prohibits the transfer of the internet. The administration's position is that prohibition expires on September 30th. And so right now I've been leading the effort, working with a number of senators, both Republicans and Democrats, and working in the House as well, to try to stop that from happening. I don't know if Congress is going to do it or not. I hope that we do. I think it is critically important because the administration wants to jam this through on September 30th under the view that the next president can't unscramble the eggs. That once it's given over, it can't come back. And indeed, one of the things we talked about the hearing that was particularly troubling was the question about whether ICANN would then flee U.S. jurisdiction and move to Europe. And we were told very comfortingly, well, its bylaws don't allow that. My response, I said, you know, it's been a while since I've taken corporations law, but am I right on this, that the bylaws can be changed at any time? Well, yes, but trust us, we don't intend to do that. I put up a poster board of testimony from the former head of ICANN, who told the Senate of France that they were studying creating a parallel organization in Switzerland for ICANN. When I asked the current CEO of ICANN, what was your predecessor talking about? Oh, I have no idea. And so this is a fight that I think preserving our institutions that preserve our freedom matters, and it's something that I'm devoting a lot of time and energy to right now. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for coming, Senator Cruz. It means a lot. How do you, with the nomination, you told us to vote our conscience, and mm-hmm. a lot of young conservatives are really having a problem with that. Do you think, in your conscience, that the current Republican nominee can be trusted to appoint and nominate conservative-minded judges that will continue to protect our rights and our freedoms? Thank you.
It's a very good question. It is not an easy question. It is a question, frankly, that I think every voter has to ask yourself. I can tell you what I'm certain of, which is that Hillary Clinton is a disaster. You know, where I am politically is I am never Hillary. If she is the president, we know that every judge and justice she appoints will be a train wreck. And that is unfortunately true on a host of other policy areas, whether it is Obamacare, whether it is immigration, whether it is national security, whether it is political correctness. I believe Hillary Clinton's agenda, her policy proposals, would be profoundly harmful for this country. I very much hope, as do millions of Americans, that we have a Republican nominee who will defend freedom and defend the Constitution. I can tell you right now I'm doing what a lot of people are doing, which is watching very, very closely. I think this election is entirely about preserving freedom and preserving the Constitution. One of the nominees ain't going to do it. I hope that the other one will. Yeah.
In a related follow-up, Senator, the Senate's position over the last year since the nomination of Merrick Garland has been to say we're going to wait to hear what the public has mm-hmm. to say before holding a hearing. Do you believe that there are, and or next year may be, the votes in the Senate to broaden that to simply saying 9 is not a magic number, and we will confirm no one who is not committed to upholding the original understanding of the United States Constitution?
Nothing would make me happier than seeing a Senate majority vigorously committed to advice and consent and imposing real teeth on that. I will say when Justice Scalia passed, my view at the time, and I said so within hours, was that the Senate should not consider any nomination to fill that vacancy during an election year, and that we should allow the people to speak, particularly when the court is hanging in the balance. It's too important. The Senate has not confirmed a Supreme Court nominee for a vacancy that occurred in a presidential election year in 80 years. And this year should not have been the first time. I will say I was pleasantly surprised and thrilled when within hours Senate Republican leadership echoed that call. And indeed, I'll do something I haven't done often. I will praise Mitch McConnell. Leader McConnell has held the line on this. He has been principled. He has been strong. Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley has been principled, has been strong. And they have been excoriated in some circles for doing so. So I am proud of the Senate Republican majority for doing their job in protecting the prerogatives of the people to vote in November and to choose the direction that the court will go and the protections that we have for the Constitution and Bill of Rights. I will tell you, if the election results are not good in November, I think it becomes harder to repose a great deal of faith that Senate majority will hold firm for long. I hope that it will, but elections have consequences. It's one of the reasons why personally, I'm devoting a great deal of time to trying to help hold on to the Republican majority in the Senate, to helping raise money for colleagues of mine, to helping use digital and data efforts to turn out conservatives in states all over the country, to hosting a number of senators down here in Texas, precisely because the one scenario I know it ain't going to be pretty is if we're ending up saying the words Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. And so I hope that doesn't happen, but this election matters.
Senator Cruz, I supported you in the primary all the way through from Iowa to Indiana. But my concern about this is sort of on a more broad philosophical position. When do we say as conservatives that the consent of the governed has been manifested to the Supreme Court and the administrative state holding our rights in abeyance, more or less the way the rest of the West has decided to do that? What is at the point where we say, yeah, the people are okay with ICANN fleeing and censorship on the internet? And when do we say, no, we continue to fight on and on and on because those words that we celebrate today were the last word that the American people really had on the fundamentals of our government?
Look, it's a great question, and it's an insightful question. I don't think it's accurate to say, though, that the American people have embraced or even consciously acquiesced with much of the slide we've seen the last 7 years in particular. There is a reason why north of 60% of Americans believe we're on the wrong track. People are dismayed at the loss of liberty. Now, in today's modern times, with there is so much noise that it's incumbent on us, I believe, to make the argument more effectively. Margaret Thatcher famously said, first you win the argument, then you win the vote. And I think the failure of conservatives, the failure of libertarians in recent years is we haven't won the argument. We haven't been making the argument. If you look at the presidential primary, and thank you for your kind support, in the primary, our single best demographic was young people. We won young people, I think, in 17 states. Our worst demographic was seniors. And I think the reason for that goes down to one thing, and that's information flow. For many senior voters, their principal and sometimes their only information flow was turning on the TV news. And the role of the media gatekeepers in these primaries, I think, has been greater than any primaries we've seen in our lifetime. For those voters for whom that was the sole source of information, they proved exceptionally difficult to reach. The reason we kept winning young people over and over again is young people we could hit with alternative information, we could hit with social media and internet and email, we could hit informed voters we would win over and over and over again. When voters heard our message, we would win. And the reason is, I am convinced freedom sells. Freedom's right. Look, the basic dynamic in national politics, conservatives, we win when we effectively articulate what we believe and the voters hear our message. Liberals win when they effectively hide and obfuscate what they believe. Because what we believe works, their policies don't work. Now, if you look nationally, roughly 50% of young people say they agree with socialism. That is a powerful indictment of each and every one of us. If you are like me, someone who believes in the American free enterprise system, who understands that socialism has been a manifest disaster in every country it's been applied, that our free enterprise system has been the greatest engine for freedom, for opportunity, for prosperity the world's ever seen, then it's incumbent on us to make that case, to make that case to the American people, to explain it, and to touch and move their hearts and minds. And so I think a great many people are unhappy with where we are, but don't necessarily know how to change it. And it's why the Federalist Society is so important. It's why I try to devote a lot of my time not to focusing on Washington and howling inside that beltway, but instead focusing on the American people. and making the case that freedom works. And I believe those values remain values that resonate if we effectively communicate. And I would point out, especially for the young people here, that as young people, you have an ability to communicate with your friends, with your peers, in a way nobody else can. You have a credibility to connect, to have fun, to laugh. You know, would it kill Republicans to have a sense of humor? Actually, I think some of them it might. But to connect in ways that makes it personal, that explains why does this matter. And it's why Constitution Day matters, to explain what, you know, why should I care about a 200-year-old piece of paper? What relevance does it have to my life? And I think it's incumbent on us to answer that question. And, you know, Reagan famously said, freedom is not passed down in the bloodstream from one generation to the next. That every generation has to stand up and defend it. Or, as he continued, one day we will find ourselves answering to our children and our children's children. What was it like in America when people were free? I mean, that's a question nobody in this room wants to answer. And the only way I know to prevent answering it is to stand up and speak the truth and connect with people's hearts and minds. And that's what I'm working to do. It's what many of you are working to do every day. And I am grateful for your leadership. I'm grateful for your principle. And I'm glad to see so many friends. Thank you.